3 p.m. It is Thursday, March 5th, in the House Judiciary Room. Martha, could you call the roll?
Representative Hopkins?
Here.
Representative Story? Representative Thompson? Representative Vance?
Here.
Representative Shaw? Representative Fields?
Here.
Representative Price-Thompson?
Here.
We have a quorum to do business. And just to give you a sense of what we're going to do today, first presentation about transition to the cloud from Department of Administration. We're going to try to do that and ask questions in an hour. And then after that, Representative Price-Thompkins will chair and go through House Bill 233, 264, and 250. So with that, does the department want to come up and talk about the cloud?
Absolutely.
Thank you. My understanding is you don't have a presentation per se, but are essentially here to answer questions and talk the committee through current state of transition to the cloud.
I've got about a 7 or 8 minute opening statement kind of giving an assessment, and then we can move right into questions.
Okay, so please place yourself on the record and proceed.
Thank you. For the record, Bill Smith. My name is Bill Smith. I am the Chief Information Officer, Department of Administration.
I am Neil Smith, Deputy CIO.
And for the record, my name is Thor Vu. I'm Alaska's Chief Procurement Officer.
And okay. You can give your opening
with your permission from the chair. Thank you. Thank you very much to the chair for the opportunity to appear before you today. There's been a good deal of confusion over our cloud migration, and I appreciate the opportunity to provide more detail. The state of Alaska currently uses both private and public cloud environments and has recently embarked on an effort to migrate sufficient or significant additional computing and storage requirements to the cloud. By increasing the use of cloud environments, the state will be able to achieve significant cost savings by paying for what we actually consume instead of buying excess capacity to handle spikes in usage. The state will also be able to create storage and computing capability without having to buy new hardware, provide dynamic disaster recovery by easily locating backups in diverse locations, and secure data in environments that maintain the strictest compliance to federal security standards. Additionally, a public cloud-based environment removes the burden of maintaining and patching hardware for the systems that are migrated. We face significant facility and hardware challenges today that will be partially addressed through our cloud migration. We recently experienced major water leaks above our Juneau data center, jeopardizing critical resources. I do have a picture, just kind of pictures worth a thousand words, of one of our server racks that's got Visqueen over top to keep the water from hitting it. For context, the Juneau data center is one of our two primary data centers within the state. Many of our 60 plus server rooms or data centers around the state face facility vulnerabilities. In the Juneau data center alone, estimates of needed repairs and improvements exceed about $750,000. Our equipment is also aging. Much of our hardware is beyond typical life cycle replacement age. An independent assessment identified a significant percentage of our physical servers as older than 5 years and some as old as 10 years of age. That represents a very significant technical debt that we've accumulated. Increasing our cloud utilization will allow us to consolidate our remaining physical assets in fewer locations, avoiding costly pending equipment purchases, and focus scarce resources on addressing a smaller number of challenges. In order to secure an appropriate cloud environment, we used a nationally competed contract vehicle. The National Association of State Purchasing Officers, or NASPO, ValuePoint Cloud Solution, was a nationally competed contract and runs from September 2016 to September 26. The request for proposal, or RFP, for the master agreement was advertised by NASPO and the State of Alaska's procurement portal as well. The RFP generated nationwide interest and proposals from 58 offerers. The RFP also includes a 2-year refresh and recompete clause to allow additional vendors to qualify and become part of the nationwide cloud solution provider network. Through the recompete process, there are currently 62 authorized resellers on contract to provide cloud solution services for states and other public agencies. The vendor we selected was a company by the name of SHI, who currently provides other Microsoft licenses and services to the state of Alaska. The selection of Microsoft Azure for our current migration effort was based on several factors. From a technical standpoint, Azure is a natural choice. Much of our current infrastructure consists of Microsoft Windows servers and Microsoft SQL databases. Leveraging Azure saves us significant cost on licensing for migrated servers and databases, and dovetails well with our current environment from a developmental tool perspective.
Can I ask a question on that?
Sure.
Are there other entities that have Windows that use cloud services from other providers?
To the chair, I don't have any specific instances of the combinations of services that other organizations or other states' entities use.
But from a technical perspective, one could have Windows computers and store data on an Amazon, a Google Cloud. It doesn't matter, right? I mean,
for the chair, it's technically possible. Where the significance comes into play is whenever there are differences like that, you quite often have to use additional layers of software for compatibility. So it increases cost, complexity, adds potential breakpoints. But from a technical standpoint, you're exactly right. And one of the things that we'll be talking about a little bit is moving to a hybrid cloud environment where you use potentially multiple public vendors. So that is technically possible. It's a little bit higher risk and cost generally, but it is possible.
Okay, thanks.
Sure. An increased focus on cloud computing also produces a skill lift for state of Alaska information technology professionals. The use of a hybrid cloud approach allows professional growth and skill development among the state of Alaska workforce. It's important to understand that our cloud migration involves outsourcing the location of physical assets, not jobs. Our IT professionals will continue to manage and maintain our servers much as they do today. They will develop a skill set in cloud storage, application, networking, and management solutions. We have secured a series of 32 technical courses that will be provided by Microsoft at no cost to the state. These courses range from cloud fundamentals to advanced technical skills and offer the opportunity for professional certification testing at no cost to our employees. Approximately 100 state of Alaska employees have already taken advantage of classes and more are scheduled. In addition to these formal classes, Microsoft Consulting Services will be providing initial project support through a temporary, no-cost engagement and helping the state of Alaska build capability within our teams to continue migration beyond the initial effort and provide long-term management of our hybrid cloud environment. Through the Alaska Administrative Productivity and Excellence, or APEX project, as well as other independent assessments, it's been documented that our statewide information technology environment is too complex and dated to provide the services that our customers expect with the resources we have. We owe our information technology professionals more. We owe Alaskans more. The cloud migration, in tandem with the APEX project, will enable us to gain efficiencies and focus resources to provide a modern and effective information technology environment. Thank you again for the opportunity to appear before you, and we look forward to answering your questions.
Okay, thanks again for being here. I don't think there's any question that migrating some data to the cloud has significant cost savings opportunities, and appreciate the opportunity to learn more about some of the details. Do committee members have questions? Representative Christakis.
Thank you. Just to sort of get basic bearings, I think it was mentioned ASHI or an entity by that name was a vendor, and can you lay out who the vendor is or who ASHI is and their relationship to Microsoft?
Absolutely. Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins. The Microsoft does not actually sell enterprise agreements directly to customers. They use a reseller model. And so all of our Microsoft enterprise agreements are through a reseller. SHI is the company that we use. There have been companies used by the state of Alaska previously with some not so great results, and SHI has been on board for several years now. We've had good response from them. They've increased the number of people that they have. It's at least nationwide, I believe, international company, but they do have a presence here in Alaska specifically because of the engagements that we have with them.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for sharing that. So am I off to sort of think of this vendor sort of being to Microsoft as a, I don't know, Cal Worthington might be to Ford Motor Company kind of thing?
Through the chair to the representative, that actually, as I was thinking about coming and speaking before you, that was exactly the analogy I was going to use. When you decide you want a Ford, you go to a dealer, and they may have multiple different types of cars, but you get the one that most meets your needs. That's
okay.
Exactly right.
Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr.
And
Chair.
No need to ask for follow-up. Go ahead.
All right, thank you. Thanks for coming and talking to us about this. It's something I have a lot to learn about for sure. Right now, it's two parts. Right now, how much of our data storage is being shifted over to the cloud under this proposal, and what is the end goal? Are we looking at all of the library and museum archives being put on this? Is it just different agencies that the Department of Administration works directly with? What is the extent now and the end goal?
Certainly, through the chair, Representative Hopkins. We don't have a firm answer for you, and the reason for that is if we want to take full advantage of the cloud environment, we have to be very careful what we put into the cloud and the manner in which we put it into the cloud. So Microsoft Azure has several different variations. Some variations are appropriate for us to take a server and just lift it and put it into the cloud as it is, whereas some other applications, it makes sense for us to refactor them, reprogram them to take advantage of tools that exist within the cloud that don't necessarily exist in the current platform. So as we're putting this project together, we're getting some of that expertise from Microsoft Consulting Services, who have done these migrations many, many times, to really do another deeper dive assessment of our data and figure out exactly what we put in the cloud, in what sequence, and in what format, so that we can maximize our savings. What we don't want to do is just lift things off of our servers, put them into the cloud, and call it good, because there are some applications that might not be appropriate for the cloud. They might not be as cost effective in the cloud. So we're going to be doing that assessment as part of this project. The independent assessment that we had done looking at our cloud readiness, and I'm going to ask Deputy CIO Neil Smith to correct me if I'm wrong, they identified of our production servers, I believe they said about 94% were available and appropriate and could go to the cloud, but we are going to be looking at what those are. Now, they didn't look at storage, so they didn't look at any of our just pure storage assets. They were looking at servers that were in production in nature. They had applications and computing functions. Our end state is not predefined, but I would fully expect that we end up with a hybrid environment where we have a public cloud presence, we have private cloud as we do today in our data center, and then we also have some on-premise functions depending what the requirements are. We don't necessarily have a predefined level in mind. The assessment identified what could go, but it's really up to us and the due diligence to determine what should go in the right format.
Thank you. So as I'm a bad millennial and I need help explaining what this would look like day to day, it's essentially our day-to-day work going to be working with this new Microsoft cloud. So, for example, our shared drive here at the legislature, I'm assuming, is on a hard frame or a hard server here somewhere, and that storage is stored somewhere here. Would that be shifting to the cloud, or would it be more overall storage? Would that be a day-to-day operations of the state agencies?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins. It really depends on the individual applications. I'll give you a couple of examples. So within the executive branch right now, our office suite, O365 from Microsoft, is cloud-based. It's in Azure today. Okay. We've been operating there for quite a while. Other applications we have in a private cloud. We've got an Oracle presence in our data center that is a private cloud, and there are line of business applications within some of the departments that function there. Because that is the appropriate platform for them. So it would really be a mix, and it would be transparent to the users when they're operating off of programs that are in the cloud versus in our data centers or in on-premise environment elsewhere. I don't know. Is there anything else you want to contribute to that?
Can I ask for clarification on that first? Is the data that's currently on the Oracle Cloud shifting to the Azure Cloud, or are you going to have multiple cloud platforms as new data shifts to Azure?
To the chair, we wouldn't anticipate the Oracle application shifting to the Azure Cloud. They really are kind of in the right place. Do you have anything else?
Yeah, Representative Hopkins, through the chair. End users are probably not going to notice any difference, much like you access your email through your Outlook. Those mail servers used to be on-premise, and now they're in Office 365. You still access your email through Outlook.
Okay. And then on that note of how many, or the end users access, in the times of when we have an earthquake or some disaster that's going to sever a fiber cable, we only have a few here in Alaska that connect us to the rest of the fiber, what's going to happen to our ability to access that data?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, it's a great question. It's something that comes up quite frequently. Really, it's incumbent on us as we design the environment to make sure that we've got appropriate disaster recovery for our environment. And that includes the few undersea cables that we have coming up here within the next few years. We should have a terrestrial link to the lower 48. So the access continues to grow. But the access as it is today is what's going to go into our assessment of how we design our platform. We will not be throwing data into the cloud in another location that needs to have a presence here in Alaska. As part of that assessment, we'll identify what the critical functions are, what the disaster recovery options are, and make sure that we have appropriate access to critical infrastructure.
While we're on the subject, could you talk about both latency in terms of data transmission from what I assume the Azure cloud, is that a data center in Seattle?
To the chair, the Azure cloud is data centers really worldwide. Our focus would be the Northwest area, so it would be in Washington, Portland, somewhere around there, with the exception of our government cloud at presence, which would probably be which would be for the more secure functions, and they would probably be in Arizona. With your permission, I'll let Neil discuss the latency. He's a little bit more on the technical side.
Okay.
To clarification, can you define latency?
Okay.
Thanks.
yes, Representative Hopkins, through the chair. Latency is basically the speed of light. It's information traveling, just like your data packets, and the further away it is, the more time it takes. So if you have servers down in the States, it's going to take a little extra time. It's you know, fractions of a second, but it actually takes time. Some applications can handle it better than others, and that will be part of our assessment. But I think, to the chair, I think that was your question, as far as us being able to handle latency. Part of the assessment is to be able to look at which applications can handle latency. Those ones will be good candidates for down the States. For example, your email can handle latency, so Office 365 makes a lot of sense to put it there. Some stuff needs to be able to be here on premise. In the case of our Oracle, it's actually there's a cloud presence, so there's cloud technology in our data center to be able to address latency. Azure has similar technologies. That is called Edge Cloud, where they actually bring the equipment closer to us to be able to address latency. And that's cloud development that has evolved over the last 10 years.
So that's equipment not in data center. That would be equipment actually based in Alaska that would improve functionality when the data is down lower 48. Could you explain how that works?
It would be equipment, to the chair, it would be actually equipment that resides in Alaska, and we would consume it just like we do any cloud service. It would be owned by Microsoft or any other cloud provider. We do that today with Oracle.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question regarding security. Is there an increase in possible breach during transition times?
In advance of the chair. Not during transition times. That is part of our plan on how we actually migrate to the cloud. We pay a lot of attention to whenever we encrypt our data, whenever we actually move it. It's called in-transit encryption. So any of our connectivity to the cloud. In the case of Microsoft, we have dedicated circuits, so it's not even going over the public internet, and it's encrypted in transit, so on the way, and when it gets there, everything in Microsoft Azure is encrypted at rest. So even if somebody were to walk into a Microsoft data center, pull out some hardware, they can't get to our data.
Thank you for that. Does this provide us an increase in our security from what we have now, or have we been at the top of the line in the security for our systems?
Representative Vance, through the chair, I will never say that we have enough security. there's always opportunities to improve it. However, with the cloud environment, as I said, Microsoft Azure has several levels or several different types of engagements. And depending on the type of engagement that you have, you're going to have a shared security responsibility with the provider, and this is the same for all cloud environments. We still have a significant cloud security responsibility in terms of developing our workflows, implementing and managing and monitoring our processes. However, the security of the hardware and the patching of the hardware, that now flows to Microsoft. And one of the things that's very critical to us is looking at the Microsoft environment, and I mentioned the government cloud is a different location. Microsoft has federally compliant, FedRAMP is one of the terms, certifications for their data centers. So while we don't have to worry about it, are the servers that our data is residing on patched to the latest security level, we do have to worry about our side of the equation. A good example or a good way to describe it that I've used in the past is we can have the best vault in the world. We can have Fort Knox, and if we leave the front door open, we're in trouble. So this doesn't take away our security responsibility, but what it does allow us to do is in instances of the data that we do move to the cloud, we get to focus our security responsibility on being even better on the process, on the front end, on the management of how we put data in and take data out. And then we also are going to be monitoring the shared security responsibility of Microsoft.
Thank you. One more question. I just had it.
Well, I'll ask a question when we go back
for
to Representative Vance. While we're on the subject, could you define public and private cloud?
To the chair, certainly. And this is also something that sometimes gets confused. Public cloud just means it's owned by a third party. It doesn't mean that there's any access from anyone besides ourselves into the data. Private cloud means we own the infrastructure, but we've got it configured in such the way that it behaves as a cloud environment. And as I said, we've got that basically in our data centers. And so as we part of our overall strategy as we collapse servers into either the cloud or to our data centers, we're developing private cloud structures, and we're enhancing those so that we still get some of the benefits functionally of a cloud, but it's on our private equipment. Obviously there we don't necessarily get all of the benefits financially and security. We still have all that responsibility. But the private cloud just means we own the equipment. Public cloud means it's owned by a third party. And then we use on-premise, which basically means servers that aren't necessarily in a cloud environment, but they're on our premise and we own them.
So it's accurate to say that DOA has a private cloud here in Alaska where we store data from multiple locations on our equipment?
Sure, yes.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that. Just since we've had transitions over time, and I think they're relevant to the current discussion, could you talk about how we move from just on-premises to on-premises with VMware and how that changed server utilization and how there is some private cloud capacity now, and talk about how much data do we have in our private cloud versus on-premises?
Yeah, do you want to cover that one?
Yeah. To the chair. Looking back at some of the older assessments, looks like back in 2010, we had one server for every 8 state of Alaska employees.
Okay.
That's when we were very much on lots of physical infrastructure. Virtual machines had probably been around since early 2000, so it was about 10 years after that the state of Alaska was still primarily on physical servers. Being able to build infrastructure that can be shared, hardware that can be shared between the various different departments, and actually virtualizing those servers. So that's a process where you can actually, you know, take a picture of a physical machine and actually start running it in the virtual machine without having to rebuild it, without having to do anything. So you can actually migrate it very seamlessly, very little downtime, and just continue running it as configured. We did the same consolidation with a lot of our storage as well. Back in 2015, there was another assessment done by NetApp storage, where a lot of it was just data was just in all the different servers, all spread out. We weren't leveraging lots of overhead that we just had to buy in order to be able to accommodate that type of capacity. So the state has has gone through that consolidation as well. So now that 90% or 80% of our data is now on, you know, shared storage infrastructure, we still have a lot of overhead, as some of our assessments are actually pointing out, which we can then we'll be able to address when we go to the cloud. You only pay for what you use.
And what percentage of data today, apart from Office 365, which I understand is already on a cloud-based platform, is on-premises versus in a private cloud? And for on-premises, are you using VMware, or is VMware effectively enabling a private cloud? I'm not sure I understand that distinction.
Okay. To the chair, yes, we are primarily using all the departments in are using primarily VMware to be able to create those virtual machines.
And that's true for whether it's on-premises or our state-managed private cloud? Both?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Lines of business are using VMware for their individual servers, and then we are trying to collapse and share some of our infrastructure onto shared infrastructure as well.
Okay. Do we have a per, I don't know, gigabyte cost, some consistent cost, looking at cost of using the private cloud versus Azure versus Google versus Amazon, pick your other cloud provider?
To the chair, we don't have all of those variations. As I indicated in my opening statement, the Microsoft Azure cloud is a very good fit for us. The clouds aren't necessarily a commodity feature. They've each got their strengths and weaknesses. We have that cost as part of the independent assessment for Azure. We're very comfortable with that cost moving forward with Azure, with the caveat that the assessment assumed that we would move a certain amount to the cloud, and again, that is going to be assessed.
And what is that amount? I assume there are parameters on what that amount will be.
Yes. So, to the chair, the assessment, and Neil, I'm going to ask you to help me out here. I think that it was, they said 94% of our servers were available and ready to go to the cloud. They could go in kind of a similar form. But I think they assumed, was it 80%? What was the percent on the migration?
To the chair, yes. The assessment said that 94% of the servers could, are cloud actually capable.
And to the chair, I'm sorry, the 80% that stuck in my head. When we did the assessment, there was a certain percentage of our servers that they could not see, that they could not reach for various reasons, and they estimated that to be about 20%. Now, we've had several independent assessments, and all of them have come up with a range of servers total statewide between 2,800 and 3,100. They've all been fairly consistent within that area. The independent The cloud readiness assessment that gave us a total cost of ownership number for moving to the cloud assumed that we would move 1,941. So that's kind of the reference point there. Again, the assumption was we would not want to move everything because it wouldn't necessarily be the best effective use of the cloud.
Quick clarification question. Was that 1,941 gigabytes of our data that we would be assumed moving, or a different number?
Through the chair, Representative.
Page 3, okay.
That is 1,941 servers.
Okay.
We do have an estimate of kind of total size of of usage. Neil, you have that, the total petabytes?
Representative Hopkins, through the chair. Yes, there were some 2015 studies as far as how much data is within the state.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like that study came up with 12 petabytes of data. So everyone understands a gigabyte, a terabyte is 1,000 gigabytes, and a petabyte is 1,000 terabytes. So within the state, we are looking at about at least 12 petabytes.
So if I had a 64K computer, which is, sorry.
Don't need more than 128K.
There you go. That's my quote, yep. Famous Bill Gates quote, yep.
I think Representative Shaw had a question.
Sorry.
Oh, okay. Okay, no problem. So little more than half of the servers, is it accurate to assume that that would also correspond to little more than half of the data? Just real roughly, you're looking at migrating to the cloud.
To the chair, I think it would be, if I were going to make an assessment like that, I would say it would probably be less than half of the data, just because what's not factored into that assessment is the storage, which has an oversized proportion amount of storage. But one of the key cost drivers and cost savings drivers, though, as I mentioned, is if we have servers that are using that we bought a machine for or we configured for and we're supporting, and they're using 10% or 20% of the available storage, when it's moved to the cloud, we pay for that 10% or 20%.
Right.
We don't pay for all the excess, whereas capital costs or hardware, we have to buy the entire machine, much like you do at home. So that's why the assessment that we got, the independent assessment, it assumed right sizing. They indicated that over 90% of our servers were over capacity because we had all this excess capacity, almost 1.75 petabytes of over capacity within our servers. And so we would get a shrinkage in that. But if you're looking at statewide data, I think it would probably be less than half initially. But as we move forward, we'll be able to assess better what needs to go in the right format.
Okay. And I should have said earlier, Representative Sean Vance arrived right after we convened, and Representative Story arrived at 3:26.
Thank you.
Do other members have questions right now? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It says, I'm referencing the response that you gave the committee on page 3, that, you know, it's talking about the number of servers and departments themselves. There's almost half of the departments are not managed by OIT. You may have addressed this in the budget subcommittee, but is there... Can you explain why OIT is not all everything isn't managed by OIT, and are you planning to transition to that? Can you give us kind of an update on what the overall goal is?
Certainly, through the chair, Representative Vance. It is correct that OIT does not manage all of the servers, all of the data within the state. I can't necessarily speak to all the details of the post AO 284 implementation, but where we're at today is we have responsibility for the majority of the commodity services, and those are services that are used statewide. Part of that is making available server management, and part of that is making available data center space and for storage. But it's really at this point still up to the departments as to what they want to take advantage of. Right now, if they move it into our infrastructure, then they get on this spreadsheet, and they finance that with chargebacks to the departments. But there are still, as you can see, a number of departments that have not made that move for various reasons. In terms of the way ahead, a large part of the APEX initiative is to determine that way ahead. And so mm-hmm. we've had the assessment phase, and they're currently, the team is working with our team as well as other departments around the state to really define the projects that we need to put in place and execute to improve our statewide IT maturity. Mm-hmm. And we expect within about the next month those projects to be reviewed and vetted and then potentially approved, and we'll start getting into the execution mode. So at this point, I don't necessarily have a picture of what the end state looks like. Certainly 284 envisioned that we would have centralization, but we want to be certain that we do it in a manner that we can support appropriately, and we can provide the needs for the needs of the customers, the departments.
Great. I have an additional question on the contract. It is over the course of 36 months, I believe.
Correct.
And can you describe what is going to be achieved in that 36 months? If you need an extension, what does that entail? And just talk a little bit more about that.
Certainly, through the chair, Representative Vance. I'll cover off on some of the aspects of your question. And then Neil, feel free to kick in terms of where you see us being at the end of 36 months here when I hand it to you. So the enterprise agreements are typically 3-year, 36 month terms. And so that's a standard rate. It's not necessarily performance based, or it's not necessarily milestone based that we expect to be at point X at that mark. As we went through to evaluate the dollars associated with it, the commits, we made some assumptions that were fairly conservative about how much we would have migrated to the cloud during that time period. And so we're very comfortable that level of commit is appropriate and achievable. In a responsible manner. I would expect that we are very well along on our migration path by that mark. Where the timing becomes a little bit varied is, as I said, not all of our applications are going to need to go to the cloud in their current form. And so while we can very rapidly move virtual machines that are currently factored for the cloud, and it will be appropriate, they're in the most cost-effective manner, we can just lift them and put them into the cloud. There's going to be time when we have to be doing some reprogramming and some refactoring and changing programs so that they can actually get the most cost effectiveness in the cloud. So those are going to become on the back end of the migration path. Neil, I don't know. We're currently trying to figure out what that project looks like in terms of milestones. But Neil, if you've got anything to contribute.
Can I jump in with a question just to make sure I understand it? So if you're moving the VMware package of data onto the cloud, are you still using the VMware vendor? Do you continue to pay for that, or does that functionality migrate to Microsoft? I'm not sure I understand that.
To the chair, the licensing, the VMware licensing, no longer go through a VMware reseller. We will go to Microsoft, and they have VMware line items where with the licensing now goes through Microsoft through that EA agreement, or which is the 3-year agreement. That is part of our math as far as figuring out, are we going to consume that amount over 3 years.
So it's an equivalent product, different company, and you still pay for that?
Equivalent product, same license to the chair, just it's now being purchased through Microsoft Enterprise Agreement versus, and the same thing will go for our storage and NetApp storage and VMware.
Okay.
And to the chair, if I could just add on that, one of the key aspects of us designing our cloud migration is hinging around a VMware, maintaining VMware presence, maintaining the NetApp presence. Those give us the ability to change our mind later on and move more easily to another cloud provider if it makes good sense for the state. So we wanted to make sure that we have portability downstream. As we become more mature, our needs may change, and other clouds might have a different offering that makes more sense.
Well, right, and that's kind of my central concern is how do we not get stuck in, with one provider who, by virtue of high exit costs, is able to price gouge us later on. And maybe you could talk more about that. Do the different cloud-based services have different contract structures with respect to egress, whether to another cloud, a private cloud, on-prem, whatever the option is?
To the chair. Yes, we have had lengthy, we call them exit strategies, as far as what if we want to come back into our own data centers, or what if we want to take advantage of a new cloud. Using the VMware tools or the NetApp tools, the same tools that we use in-house right now, allows us to do a couple things. It allows our certain trained skill set so that our current IT people who support it have a familiarity. There's going to be some variations, but they will have a familiarity to be able to manage virtual servers and storage in the cloud just like they are on-premise. We expect some of that to be on-premise. It's called a hybrid cloud and in the cloud. And then also, as far as the exit strategy is concerned, those tools literally allow us to drag virtual machines from the cloud back to premise. Or if Amazon Web Services or Google Cloud Services turns out to be a better one in 3 years after the renewal of the agreement, they also have VMware tools, so we can actually use those same tools to be able to
from cloud to cloud.
Literally drag our cloud. It's called multi-cloud. We literally drag our servers from one cloud to the other. We will want to pay attention to the billing factor of it. That can get very complex. Some recommendations are that you actually get a third party to help you with the billing because of the complexity in the case of Amazon Web Services. In the case of Microsoft and Azure, we get significant discounts, both in Windows Server, about 40% licensing discounts for Windows Server, and up to 55% discounts as far as our SQL services are concerned. You had asked earlier, as far as can Amazon Web Services or Google Services support SQL? Yes, if you build a server, a Windows Server, and put SQL on it, and then you have to pay for all those metering there. In that case, it can cost 4 to 5 times more to run SQL in Amazon or Google versus in Azure, which is factored for SQL.
Go ahead, Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. You had said earlier in your presentation that this is going to be a more of a hardware change than a jobs or work change. And you'd mentioned a little bit about the 32 different training programs that the OIT workers are going to be going through, and how they'll develop a familiarity. Can you talk more about how we're not going to be losing jobs in Juneau for this or around the state, and where some of those jobs might be, and what that will look like?
Certainly through the chair, Representative Hopkins. Absolutely, that's obviously a critical piece of this. So we mentioned the fact that we're using virtual machines today, and they are just sitting on our servers or on hosted devices here within the state.
Mm-hmm.
So the aspect of work that we don't do after we migrate to the cloud is we basically don't get that piece of hardware, that machine, and we don't screw it into a rack and mm-hmm. connect the wires on the back. Today, we do that, and then our IT professionals go somewhere to a desktop, or they go to a computer, and then they jump in and they start doing their programming, they start doing their work. That somewhere might be in the same building, it might be in Anchorage working on a machine in Juneau, or vice versa. Under the cloud scenario, they just sit down at the desktop, they sit down at the computer, they go into a portal for Amazon, they create a virtual machine, and then they start doing their programming. And so the functioning of the way that we work with our servers today for the vast majority of them doesn't change. We move away from that one manual piece, and we add some additional skill sets. And those additional skill sets are the ability to get into the cloud and to take advantage of the tools that are inherent into the cloud to be the most efficient, to create the most efficient program possible. So it's one piece of the puzzle that in many cases a lot of our IT professionals have already shed as we went to virtual machines, but it does not change the requirement that we have for internal State of Alaska IT professionals to be programming, managing, and taking care of our servers in the cloud or in local premise.
Thank you. So is there going to be some type of physical or technical repair or programming repair or something where we're going to have to wait for somebody from Microsoft to come up and work on something for us? What is going to be an expectation of delays in the future if this is ever, what could cause those delays in the future? Having somebody to come up and look at it specifically like we did with, you know, having to wait for the Rolls-Royce worker to come work up on the ferries.
Do you want to cover that?
Sure. Yes, Representative Hopkins, through the chair. Part of going to the cloud is to make sure that we have a disaster recovery, set up our disaster recovery options. Very much like we have copies of all the servers in Juneau are sitting up in Anchorage, and actually vice versa. In the event that the servers here are break, we can actually fail over and begin and turn up those and beginning using those copies. The cloud is going to be very much the same way. Microsoft Azure has, you know, 40-something data centers and actually counting. So we will be able to pick, here's a critical server, we will make a copy of it, and we can pick a geo-diverse location, you know, someplace far away so that it's not going to be affected by the same natural disaster. So if something goes down, we expect very minimal downtime as far as being able to turn up a copy of that server and for people to continue working.
Okay, a follow-up on that. Are there any reasons that a Microsoft technician or programmer will have to come up to work on something within this contract?
So, Representative Hopkins, through the chair, for the cloud services, in terms of them coming up here physically in Alaska, no, unless we downstream end up having cloud instances within Alaska, which, as Neil May mentioned, it is possible for Microsoft to stand up computer stacks within Alaska. It's transparent to us whether it's in Alaska or Oregon or Washington, except for the latency. What little latency is there is reduced. If it was Microsoft equipment doing those functions, then they would be repairing those. But a key point on that is we would not necessarily be waiting for them. Part of the architecture of putting things into the cloud is exactly what Neil talked about, that failover. And there are SLAs that Microsoft provides in terms of downtime for those servers, automatic switching to go over to backups and things of that nature. So we take advantage of the 3 to 5 million servers that Microsoft has by getting that depth of redundancy. So
clarification, SLAs, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Service level agreement to the chair, which basically just states that we will have a limited amount of downtime in the event of something happens to one of the devices. And I don't know what those exactly are off the top of my head, but it's well defined in terms of limiting our exposure to any kind of downtime. That management of the hardware and the ability to provide redundancy is one of the core benefits of being in the cloud environment, because it takes it off of our plate.
So just to repeat back to you to make sure I understand, no, Microsoft technicians and programmers are not going to have to come up here to work on-site on something that would cause a delay in us getting access to our data.
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, for what we put into the cloud, correct?
Okay, you keep...
The reason I say that is because under a hybrid cloud environment, we still anticipate having Windows servers in our own premise.
Okay.
If something happens to those, that's outside of this agreement on the cloud.
Gotcha.
So for what we put in the Azure cloud, absolutely, I concur with your statement.
Okay, thank you. We're going to have to switch, Chairman, because I have to go to another committee. I apologize for that, but I did hope that you could address the committee. Please get into a little more detail about the nature of the contract. I see a $15 million contract. Are the fees listed in the Microsoft Consulting Services Work Order Agreement on top of that, or is $15 million just what we're paying? Thank you.
Absolutely, to the chair, and I can answer that right now. Is okay. So, the enterprise agreement has a commit to consume of $15 million, and what that means is we are going to be billed as we go on a monthly basis based upon the resources that we consume on the cloud. So, if we didn't put anything on the cloud for the first 12 months, we get no bills under this enterprise agreement. It's all based upon what we actually move and what we're consuming. The $15 million is a commitment that we made to Microsoft that we will consume that within 36 months. If at the end of 36 months we have not consumed that amount, we get invoiced for the balance, but then we get a credit back good for 12 months for that amount. So we get another 12 months to consume that we've already prepaid for. So it's basically 48 months to pay. The invoicing happens at 36. As Neil indicated, we mapped out what we believe our usage to be, and even on the conservative side, we don't see a problem with us migrating enough to cover that commitment to consume. In terms of the Microsoft Consulting Services Agreement, there are on that document, there are services that are listed with pricing, and I believe the price total is somewhere around $1.5 million. That is the value of those services. There's also a stipulation on that document that says that we will be billed nothing for those services. The way that this agreement is set up, the enterprise agreement commit to consume $15 million yielded 10% incentive-based credits from Microsoft that are going to Microsoft Consulting Services to cover the cost of those services. So our only cost under the three documents that we sent is a commitment to consume $15 million of cloud services within 3 years, within 36 months, again, that we can consume actually over 48. The importance of that Microsoft Consulting Services piece was the fact that we are not mature in our cloud knowledge today. We need to grow that capability internally so we can be self-sustaining. We also are very cognizant of the fact that if we don't set up our environment properly and we don't make good choices in workflow and security and what we move to the cloud, then we won't save as much money as we anticipate. So we wanted to bring in experts to help us set that project up, help define the milestones, help us map it out, and then also help move the first large amount of servers. The statement of work, which I believe also was included in the document, stipulates that they are going to be moving about 100 plus servers in addition to doing other services for us. During that time frame, in addition to the formal training our employees will be receiving on cloud migration and cloud maintenance, they're also going to be sitting side by side with Microsoft Consulting Services folks to learn how to do this and then pick up that baton and continue to move forward. So the migration is not going to be done completely by Microsoft Consulting Services, but by getting that credit from Microsoft, we were able to finance that standing up of the project, and then the knowledge transfer, the initial migrations, and then we can take it forward from there.
Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. Yeah, with that $15 million the commit to consume, two questions. I guess just to make sure I understand it right, we're on the bill. We're on the hook for $15 million in 3 years, whether we use it or not. And I understand there's the 12-month extension for it, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, that is correct.
Okay. And is that 32 different training courses that I'm assuming are going to be ongoing outside of the first 32 days or however long it'll take for people to take those courses. Is that included in that $15
million? Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, yes. So those courses are being provided by Microsoft at no cost to the state. And they start out with a fundamental course that a large body of folks are going to be taking. We, as I said, we've had 100 in Anchorage. We're scheduling, I believe it is in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 100 seats in Juneau for our technicians, and we're going to continue to expand that. So it's a foundational level. And then there's also going to be a couple tracks depending on what functions, what jobs the individuals have, and so that they're going to be getting very deep into, you know, cloud architecture or administration or whatever the function is. Those 32 classes are going to be spread over a little bit of time because they build on a foundation and they continue to progress. And as you get into the higher levels of classes, the groups will narrow because it's much more depth and much more applicable to exactly what they're going to be doing on a day-to-day basis.
Is there any kind of path dependency associated with this contract with HSI or being sort of in the Microsoft Azure sort of ecosystem in terms of cloud data storage? In other words, is the state of Alaska committing itself to a certain means of formatting data? Are there going to be high transaction costs if after 5 or 10 years there's a more competitive vendor, but the transition costs are so great that we can't avail ourselves to us and we're effectively dependent and at the whim, including at the whim of possibly increasing costs with Azure or HSI?
Right. And
or SHI, chair, excuse me.
To the chair, that is a key factor, the architecture as we stand this up and making sure that we set it up appropriately at the beginning. And I'll let Neil kick off.
To the chair, we are using the tools in anticipation of that. We want to commit to maybe, you know, 3 years at a time, and then whatever the next technology makes the most sense to be able to do that. So we are building in the tools that allow us that flexibility. We are also looking at, there's different types of circuits, metered or unmetered circuits, and so we're going to look at what makes the most sense, the most cost-effective sense to us as far as, you know, if we have to get out, what is the price? I know there's a lot of discussion, you know, that it can be very expensive to get out of the cloud. You can buy circuits that are unmetered, and so you can pull your data back and forth without any additional cost. We are considering those, but they have to make financial sense.
I don't understand the technical context of metered and unmetered circuits, but I guess just and that's fine. But I mean, just to sort of boil down my question to the absolute pith and essence of it, I mean, is there a path dependency here as the state enters into this contract and goes down this path with Azure?
To the chair. We are working to make sure that there is not, and that's part of that. That's part of that increasing our maturity level and understanding. Microsoft Contract Consulting Services is going to be a big part of helping us with that. But to your point, we are absolutely looking at this with the end in sight and with the possibility that there's a better option at the end of this 36 months. And how do we position ourselves not just in the meantime, but also to be ready at any time to pick a better option? The metered and unmetered is simply unlimited path versus charged by how much you send up and down. So if you're charged by how much you send up and down, it's cheaper. But when you do a whole bunch, all of a sudden, now it's much more expensive than the unmetered. And so as we're looking at it, if we were going to be looking at pulling data off in mass, the unmetered, even though it's more costly on a monthly basis, might be the better option if we anticipate that we'll be going down that route. And so that's what Neil's talking about with picking the right tool for our data so that we don't get locked in. We're very cognizant of the fact that whether it's on servers on our core network or whether it is switches or whatever we use, whether it's laptops, desktops, we do not want to be beholden to one specific vendor or one specific technology. We want to keep our options open so we can make the best choices.
To the chair, think of your old day, in the old days with your cell phone where you were charged by each text message. That would be metered, whereas if you have a flat fee, regardless of the amount of text that you send back and forth, that would be unmetered.
That makes sense in terms of metered, unmetered. So I think the takeaway I got from your answer was we're working hard to avoid a path dependency, but it's not fully explicit whether there is always the possibility of a path dependency. Am I accurate in inferring that from your answer?
To the chair, if Depending how we set it up, yes. But it's really within our control, and that's why we're working hard on the front end to be sure that we make the right choices.
And a couple of financial questions. I've always enjoyed sitting on the Department of Administration Finance Subcommittee. Mm-hmm. I like the budget, and I like efficiency, and that's why I like Department of Administration. So I'm probably one of the minority of legislators in this building that absolutely enjoys that. 5 years from now, or 10 years from now, whenever, say, you anticipate the cloud data migration to have been completed, fully realized, what is the year-over-year operations budget spend reduction relative to our sort of incumbent or previous data storage system?
To the chair, I would love to be able to give you a firm number, but unfortunately with our cost accounting and the way that we track our IT spend at the state today, we don't have a great reference point for what we spend today. Part of our APEX initiative is to really get granular and make sure that we can capture that entire IT spend across the state in a manner that allows us to make those assessments. What I can tell you is that part of the third-party independent assessment looked at total cost of ownership on those 1,941 servers based upon industry standard rates, and then they looked at those same servers migrated to the Azure environment with the pricing. And so that is where we were able to see, okay, that snapshot shows a significant cost reduction. Where we ran into trouble with equating that to what we have on the ground, we don't have a particular place that has a total cost of ownership capacity. So for instance, we've got over 60 rooms, 60 data centers and data closets around the state, more like 90, but over 60 that have at least two racks of data. I don't know what we pay for power on each and every one of those because they belong to so many different agencies and they're buried in so many different locations. So when we look at total cost of ownership, we're not just looking at the piece of equipment and the monthly rate and the software. We're also looking at the heating, cooling, all of those other elements. And that's where we really have a gap in terms of what our historical knowledge is for the state of Alaska. Good news is we're fixing that. The APEX project is going to really bring that into check. So moving forward, we'll be able to address that. In terms of this cloud migration, Neil and I are working very hard as part of this project plan to be sure that we're capturing every piece of equipment that gets turned down because of it, because we migrate. We don't want to lose anything and inadvertently keep cost going on because we missed a spot, because we missed a server that we needed to turn down when we migrated it. So we are committed to maximizing our cost efficiency. But unfortunately, with our current environment, I don't have a good year-over-year present future number to provide you.
Thank you. Could you extrapolate or guess what it would be given some of the snapshots that you referenced?
To the chair.
In percentage terms?
Sure. To the chair. So the independent assessment that I referred to indicated that total cost of ownership for those 1941 servers using industry standard costs of ownership figures would be about $45 million annually. Did not include labor, and that's important. It doesn't include labor. On the Azure side, it indicated for those same 1941 servers, reduced in size to just what you really needed and moved to the cloud, it would be about $6 million. So directionally about $39 million. As I said, labor was not factored into either one of those. It was pulled out. And that roughly, if we believe that we spend, our IT spend is in the ballpark of about $250 million a year, which is kind of where we've narrowed in on, although it's still not 100% accurate, I don't think. But if we believe that, and $83 million or so of that is labor, and we pull that out so that we're talking apples to apples, the independent assessment had us with a savings of about 23%. The Gartner, I don't know if you're familiar with Gartner, but Gartner is an intelligence gathering and consulting firm internationally known for IT consulting. Their studies indicate that an average savings is around 21% on a massive cloud migration. So the independent assessment kind of is directionally in line with that 23%, the 23 and 21%. Additionally, we've had other third parties take a look at it, not necessarily as granular, but the commissioner has been talking with other communications companies, third parties, who have looked at it and said that directionally they think that those numbers are appropriate. Again, those are run rate numbers, so it doesn't include necessarily the transition time period. But once you're established with those 1941, that is the number that came out of that assessment, again, based on industry standards.
Okay. Take one last question, and then I think we're at one question from both sides of the dais, and then we're going to move on to our bills. Representative Vance.
I was just going to comment that I share your enthusiasm for finding the efficiencies, and especially for the state just modernizing and becoming just more cutting edge to be able to provide services to make our employees be able to do their jobs to the maximum, but also be able to provide the services for Alaskans. So I'm very excited at what IT and DOA is doing in this project in being able to reduce the spend so that we can maximize every dollar for Alaskans.
Representative Story.
Yeah, thank you. My question had to do with our personnel. And I know when we met in our subcommittee, finance subcommittee, that Commissioner Chewbacca had talked about that we were not laying anybody off through this move, and we were not, of course, filling vacant positions. These were vacant positions that we had let go. But I am wondering, this is a big change. I am wondering the communication with staff. I would think it would cause a lot of uncertainty to me if I was in the position and we were doing this big change. And I am wondering I know staff is getting training, but how do they get a briefing of how the project's going? Who is explaining the steps that we're taking and the overall big picture?
Through the chair, Representative Story, I'm glad you asked that, because I've only been in this position for about 100 days now, but one of my priorities was that transparent communication. I know that Commissioner Chewbacca shares that. Since well before I came on board, she's been doing monthly town halls where people call in and ask questions, and with all of DOA, and a large percentage of those questions typically are from the Office of Information Technology, understandably with all the changes. Since I've been coming on board, I've also started a town hall cadence. I've only had one of those so far, but from the time I came on, every two, sometimes 3 weeks, I send an all OIT information email out that basically gives updates and says, hey, here's what we're doing, here's where I see us going, here's our vision, and I've gotten good positive feedback from that. Additionally, as part of the APEX initiative, which really is tied to the modernization and the improving our efficiency and maturity IT-wise statewide, we have had probably at least five or six briefings and information sessions where we basically set up a call, go through the slides, be totally transparent on what the assessment was. And it's been great that we did that, because there were a couple of those where people called out and said, hey, I don't think I got a survey. And we went back and checked, and sure enough, the survey group was not quite correct. And so we issued a new survey to be sure we could capture everybody's viewpoint on the self-assessment, for instance. So we're working very hard to be as transparent as possible and to be talking to people on a routine cadence. As the cloud migration specifically moves forward, we don't have our list of key performance indicators and progress reports nailed down yet, but we're working hard to identify them, and we're envisioning basically public displays around our work areas saying, hey, here's where we're at, here's the number of servers we've moved, here's what we've gained, here's what we're doing. So we're trying to be as transparent as possible. That being said, it's never enough, so we're going to continue to try to reinforce those messages, because I absolutely understand the concerns our workforce has. But it really is an exciting time for them to get a skill set lift. And then also within the state of Alaska, I really look forward to the point where we're so much more efficient and so much better performance in terms of how we satisfy our customer needs that we can start stepping up into the really high-level IT functions, artificial intelligence, big data analytics, and do some things that are really challenging but going to be really, really beneficial to the state of Alaska as a whole.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Story, a short comment?
Yeah, a short comment. I know we have different degrees of expertise and knowledge within staff, and I'm just assuming that there's a feedback link where staff is saying, hey, I'm seeing this, and I think we should be going this way, or have you considered this? Kind of more of our people who are more high-tech positions. just comment that it's just not you guys helping them, but, you know, getting that feedback.
Through the chair, Representative Story, we have Neil hosts a meeting weekly with the Department of Technology officers and others throughout. We're really looking for those thought leaders within our IT community to help steer the path. It's not something that we can just say this is the way it needs to go. We're getting that feedback.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Story, for the question and the comment. And I think just on that note, I mean, I don't have the full context, nor do I think I have I looked into this as much as my co-chair has, but I saw an article this morning from ASEA, and it sounds like there is some contention and friction. And so I also would urge and counsel more communication. And I think Representative Story might be coming at a similar direction, because, I mean, cloud is really the future. I think anybody in tech would agree. Nobody would deny that, but just doing it right is important. Mr. Smith, Mr. View, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
So we've got three bills on today's hearing. HB 233 from Representative Vance, first hearing. HB 264 from myself, relating to proof of insurance and unsatisfied judgments, and HB 250 from Representative Hopkins. It's an all-state affairs affair in state affairs. Very exciting. And Representative Vance has a bill up, or Shaw, next week, so we're going to keep our streak up. So we'll start with you, Representative Vance, and staff, Ms. Ogun. Please come forward and present the bill. I'm going to keep an eye on time to see if we sort of chug through today's hearing and try to keep each first hearing at ideally no more than 15 minutes. And given that there's only four of us left, I think that should make the economization that much more possible. Please put yourself on record and present the legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for allowing me the opportunity to present my bill. I'm Sarah Vance, and I represent House District 31.
Good afternoon, committee members. I'm Janet Ogun. I'm staff to Representative Vance.
House Bill 233 is an act relating to the display of documents on electronic devices. We as consumers enjoy the benefits of having access to information in the palm of our hand, and the state of Alaska recognizes the demand for mobile device use and is currently in the process of allowing users to provide proof of state-required documents such as licenses, permits, and insurance to a peace officer via mobile device. Alaskans treasure our privacy and have enshrined that right in our state constitution under Article 1, Section 22, Right to Privacy. The right to the people of privacy is recognized and shall not be infringed. HB 233 safeguards the privacy of individuals who display any state-required document to peace officers by ensuring that displaying proof of a required document does not constitute consent for a peace officer to access other contents of the electronic device. In layman's terms, if a wildlife trooper asks to see your fishing license, the trooper does not automatically have a right to search other content on your device. You must give permission to the trooper to view anything else besides the license required by law. The two examples of this already specified in statute are in AS 28.22.019D pertaining to the displaying of proof of a motor vehicle liability insurance and AS 03.05.078B pertaining to display a proof of registration when transporting industrial hemp. So the reason that I initially thought of introducing this bill is because the state now allows fishing licenses to be displayed on electronic device like your mobile phone. And thinking about people who are showing their fishing license may have other things that would cause some suspicion that may not be guilty of breaking a law. And so I wanted to ensure that Alaskans have their privacy secured in any such case. But I wanted to expand and look to the future as we are modernizing our state by allowing licenses, permits, and other documents to be viewed on a device, for the language in this bill to encompass all of those that are required and allowed by law to be displayed on an electronic device. So it's not limited to just fishing, hunting, and trapping licenses or motor vehicle insurance. The bill defines required document means a license, permit, or insurance card required by law that may be displayed electronically. So I'm hoping that this will encompass future permits and licenses that may not be currently in statute at this time.
Thank you. Any questions?
Sure, I have a question.
Representative Story.
Might just be, I would think, and I'm not seeing the difference in that we have protections under reasonable search and seizure laws, and so at least I think we do. So I am wondering why you feel this should be more specific. Wouldn't the electronic devices, wouldn't whoever was checking your legality for what you were doing, the peace officer, whoever, wouldn't they know they would have to get searched and seizure if they wanted to look at something more on your phone or another item?
Allow my staff. Oops, we're a little tight here.
For the record, this is Janet Ogan. Yes, we do have that, but I think what we're trying to do here is really to spell out, you know, the future. You know, we may have, but you have to have a warrant for those, you know, reasonable things. You have to have that. But if you're here, you know, and you're showing your electronic device to a peace officer, we're just saying this does not allow you consent to do that. So I think we're just trying to look forward to that. This is the wave of the future. You know, so many more things are probably going to be added onto our mobile devices, and we just want to make sure that we're being proactive and not just, you know, going, well. So, you know, we're just taking a proactive view on this.
Follow up.
So
in using warrants and search and seizure, there's no mention of electronic devices?
Not that I'm aware of.
I'll just follow up. I get what you're doing and support it. I'm co-sponsoring the bill. I think knowing definitively, and it's maybe some follow-up research would be helpful, like where the line is in terms of protections that currently exist on a civil liberties basis, sort of in receipt of Representative Story's question, could be helpful for reference, just to get a sense of, like, given what the baseline level of sort of civil liberty protection is, what is the marginal new protection offered by HB 233.
Thank you for that, Mr. Chair. As far as I know, an op peace officer must have probable cause or come with a warrant. But this also provides the resident of Alaska the knowledge that they are in control of their information and the device. And so they are the ones that give consent, rather than the other way around. And I think we often feel vulnerable with a peace officer when we are having to present information. And with a paper license, that's all that they are obtaining and looking and viewing at the time. But with our mobile devices, we hold almost all of our information that's near and dear to us on that mobile device, whether that's digital health, photographs, you know, things like that. And so it does provide that assurance to Alaskans that your privacy and your right to your information is in your hands.
Thank you, Representative Vance. I think that's helpful. I mean, in effect, beyond the sort of letter of the law, some of the value of HB 233 that you're stating is that it on a symbolic, it's not quite the right word, but in sort of a confidence level to the common citizen, that it reasserts or emphasizes the rights that they have. Any other questions from the committee? Yeah. Representative Hopkins.
Just a quick little fact one. Outside of the hunting and fishing licenses and our car insurance, what other types of information are we currently allowed as Alaskans to provide only as electronic instead of paper? Like, driver's license obviously is not one of them yet, but what are some of the other forms?
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Hopkins. The only other thing that is allowed to display electronically is a particular registration for transporting industrial hemp.
Oh, right.
It's a very narrowed permit. And then obviously our proof of auto insurance, since over the past number of years, auto insurance has moved to just being able to go online and with a few clicks, you have insurance. So instead of going through each instance of required documents that are going to be allowed on mobile devices, I wanted to have one statute that would encompass everything so that there wouldn't be licenses, permits, documents that would fall through the cracks as we move into the future, that citizens would have this provision that allowed for their privacy. But as far as looking to the future, I know that the Department of Fish and Game is trying to get more of their licenses and permits online, and they're currently working on an app. And that's something that a large percentage of Alaskans use and are looking forward, have great anticipation to be able to present those electronically, and wanted to make sure that we have this provision in place.
Thank you.
Well, on the subject of insurance, that might be a great segue to the next bill on today's agenda. Thank you, Representative Vance, and I'm setting an amendment deadline of 5 p.m. next Monday, March 9, for HB 233, and we'll take public testimony on the Tuesday meeting and look to the will of the committee. At that time, thank you very much for presenting the legislation. Second item on today's agenda, as far as bills go, is HB 264 from my office, and this relates to proof of insurance and unsatisfied judgments. Mr. Harris is here to make a presentation on the bill, and also we have Lori Wing-Heyer from the Division of Insurance as well available for questions, which I expect might be forthcoming given the subject matter. Mr. Harris, not quite welcome, but welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name, for those of you who don't know me, is Reed Harris. I'm staff to Chair Christ-Tompkins. House Bill 264 deals with this almost anomaly in statute that we encountered when we were looking, and it has to do with unsatisfied judgments, which, if you receive one, will require what's called a proof of financial responsibility, POFR, what we commonly call SR-22 these days. It's a common misconception that SR-22 is, in fact, insurance. It is not. What it is a certificate an insurer sends to the Department of Motor Vehicles stating that this high-risk individual has insurance. You may ask, how do I become a high-risk individual and get this sort of certification required on my in order to have my license restored? DUIs are the most common thing. And the other thing is an unsatisfied judgment, which, if you don't mind, I'll just read from my notes for a quick second. Excuse me. Excuse me, twice over.
No rush.
Had it right in front of me when I needed it or didn't need it. An unsatisfied judgment is when you are in an accident and you cause either death, bodily injury, or damage to property over $501. Generally, it's the property damage is what we're talking about here. And then you don't pay for whatever damage you have caused. A judge will issue an unsatisfied judgment against you, and then your license is subsequently revoked by the Department of Motor Vehicles. You can't get it back until you satisfy or stay the judgment. If the judgment is stayed, that means the judge has essentially ruled that it's okay, what occurred, it was actually not your fault. If it's satisfied, it means that you paid the judgment. Like if I were to crash my car into someone else's car and cause $20,000 worth of damage, I would need to pay that person that amount in order to have the judgment satisfied. The unique thing about unsatisfied judgments in Alaska, if I could turn the committee's attention to the document with the DMV header on it, just to kind of lead into it, if you get a first offense DUI, you have to have SR-22 for 5 years. A second offense is 10 years. A third offense is 20 years. A fourth offense is a lifetime requirement for SR 22. At that point, you've basically proven to the state that you cannot be a responsible driver. So you're required to have this additional certificate in addition to paying your regular insurance premiums. In addition to a fourth offense DUI, DWI, unsatisfied judgment, just one, will also land you in that same bracket where you have a lifetime SR 22 requirement. I called Ledge Research and did a little digging. We have not been able to find why that is there. It's kind of unusual. So this bill addresses that and says if your judgment is stayed or satisfied, you, instead of having a lifetime SR 22 requirement, have to have SR 22 for 3 years after the judgment is stayed or satisfied. So if I get in an accident, cause damage to a vehicle, and don't pay it, I still can't get my license back after paying SR 22 for 3 years. I still have to pay the have to satisfy the judgment, pay, and then I have to have SR 22 for 3 years additionally as sort of my punishment to teach me to be a more responsible driver in the future. I wanted to point to the committee's, or bring the committee's attention, this committee actually in the last legislature, the 30th, drafted House Bill 409, which addressed unsatisfied judgments as well as DUIs and tried to do a revamp of that whole system. The Department of Administration at the time was rather against that, namely because of the DUI. It kind of viewed as loosening up laws on that. This bill just addresses unsatisfied judgments. We had gentlemen from the therapeutic courts in here last week during a presentation, and the chair asked one of them about SR-22 just sort of tangentially, since the gentleman mentioned he'd had a few DUIs himself, and he said, coming from trying to pull himself up by his bootstraps and coming from a lower income area and things like that, paying the SR-22 premium was very difficult for him. Some information I received from our Division of Insurance is SR-22 can cost anywhere from 5 to 50% of your standard premium. So he was paying hundreds of dollars a month, I believe he said, in order to have SR-22, in order to retain his license so that he could get to and from work and other things.
500, I think. 500. Said, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That is quite a bit of money for anyone, especially someone who's kind of coming out of possibly the penal system and trying to get their life straight. So we felt in our office that this particular nominally in statute is really targeting low-income people and those that are trying to potentially improve themselves. So this is why we drafted this bill. I think that's the entirety of my presentation at the moment. If there's any questions.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I love the idea of restitution and it being complete, but I was wondering why did you choose 3 years as the time period?
The rhyme or reason behind that would be it seemed like it was an appropriate amount of time for someone to continue to, by having 3 years of SR-22, you're proving to the state through the DMV that I made a mistake and I am now going to fix this. I'm going to have my SR-22 for 3 years. It's really just chosen. It seemed like an appropriate amount of time. 10 years seemed like a little bit long. 1 year was possibly a little bit short.
I'm going to jump in there. I mean, this bill, I think I'm going to state as a bit of a placeholder, and I think it's going to be beneficial for this committee to look at the value of SR-22, the value that it offers to the public, mm-hmm. categorically, independent of the particular change that exists in HB 264 as presently written. The 3 years is effectively sort of an arbitrary number that, as Mr. Harris said, sort of makes sense if you look at the other SR-22 requirements presently in statute. I think it will be beneficial, however, to look at sort of the overall universe of these requirements. The SR-22 laws were put on the books before mandatory car insurance was the law of Alaska. And so there's a relationship between those two that I think when Ms. Swinghire is available, we can learn more about. But hope that helps.
Yes, thank you.
And through the chair, if I may, in answer to Representative Vance's question, if you turn to the last document, the SR-22 legislative research document, I'll just read again, but this is from 1956. The legislature is concerned over the rising toll of motor vehicle accidents and the suffering and loss thereby inflicted. The legislature determines it is a matter of grave concern that motorists shall be financially responsible for the negligent acts. That was more or less the seat of SR-22. The state's mandatory insurance laws came in later, many years later, in fact.
Representative Hopkins?
Yeah, thank you for finding this weird loophole or how, problem, it seems like, or disconnect. What in that presentation you referenced when the chair asked about SR 22 for the person from the therapeutic courts, he said it is now a lifetime. At some point, it's now a lifetime requirement to have SR 22 for the rest of your life. Was that a change in HB 49 last year? Do I remember that right, or did that happen previously and is the older statute that we're trying to work on now?
HB 409 did not pass.
The 49, sorry, 49, the crime bill from last year. I thought it dealt with some of the insurance and some of the penalties on DUIs.
Yeah, I can speak to that. I think I know what you're referring to as far as HB 49, but I'm fairly sure that it actually didn't touch SR 22 okay. provisions, but related getting driver's licenses mm-hmm. sort of back as a vehicle to employment and being a productive citizen. But Ms. Winghire may be more familiar. I should also note that Joanne Olson, the interim DMV director, is online. She can confirm or clarify or correct what I just said. Actually, I think we might as well just run with the expert. Ms. Olson, if you're online, could you put yourself on record and either correct what I said or otherwise speak to Representative Hopkins's question?
This is Joanne Olson with the Division of Motor Vehicles. Chair?
We can hear you. Thank you, Ms. Olson. What, did you hear Representative Hopkins's question?
No, I didn't. I'm sorry. Could you repeat it?
Certainly, no problem at all. Thank you for being here to help us today. The aide to the Chair, Chris Tompkins, mentioned that at some point SR 22 is a you're required to have it for the remainder of your life in that in type of insurance. And I was wondering if that was changed to require that lifetime maintenance of the SR 22 insurance, if that was changed in House Bill 49 last year that passed the crime bill, or if that just had to do with being able to get your license back after various types of motor vehicle crimes.
No, I'm not familiar with that bill from last year.
Okay, no worries. I'll just do my own research. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. I don't know the answer either.
Through the chair, I'm happy to follow up with that in a second presentation for this bill. Perhaps next week.
I want to call forward Lori, but any other questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Harris. Thanks for being here, Ms. Winghire.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lori Winghire. I'm the director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska, and happy to take your questions if I can answer them.
Great. I think you're probably well suited. So SR 22, this is like the jargon's jargon almost. Let me just attempt a definition for what this is, and you can confirm or correct. SR 22 is a certificate of proof of insurance, or what's the, like the one sentence definition, just to refresh us on what SR 22 is?
Mr. Chairman, an SR 22 filing is exactly that. It's a certificate to the state that you currently have liability insurance on the vehicle that you are driving or have access to.
And a follow up, I mean that. It seems a little redundant if there's mandatory insurance in Alaska that you need a certificate to prove that you have insurance. Can you explain that relationship?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I can on that. I do know that when you go to renew your tags, let's say, on a vehicle, you check a box that says you do have insurance on the vehicle to satisfy the state laws. This is just another step that has been in statute for a number of years on an individual to say that that individual, because of either the unsatisfied judgment or the violations that Mr. Reed Harris talked about, that they have been asked to again certify that they have liability insurance on the vehicle that they either drive or have access to. And have access to, you may not own a vehicle, but you have access to a corporate vehicle that you're asked to drive. So that vehicle, in essence, would have to have the SR-22, or you have access to your mother's vehicle. That's what you use that vehicle would have to have the SR22 to satisfy your requirement.
Why does it cost so much if, in effect, like say $500 a month or whatever it is, if, in effect, I have my car insurance policy through Allstate, I'm already paying my premiums to Allstate, but I have to get this other piece of paper that costs $500 a month that, in effect, just says that I have my car insurance policy from Allstate?
Mr. Chairman, part of it is the violation itself. And the other part, and I will tell the committee that when the representative brought this bill to us to look at, we looked at 23 insurance companies in the state of Alaska. We could only find six that were writing or providing SR22 to insureds when asked. So it narrows down. They then add, or the insurers are allowed to rate on your driving record. And so that, well, if you've had a DUI or if you've had a reckless driving or such, of course that's going to cost more. With the SR22, it's kind of a red letter, if you will, scarlet letter, saying that, you know, there was some reason of why you were being asked to keep this filing on file with, or this certificate on file with the state. And so, of course, the insurers are a little bit more hesitant to write someone who has an SR22. Now, saying that, it's not saying they won't, but someone may be moved not just from a preferred market, but to a substandard market, and then have a surcharge on top of their normal premium. And I want the committee to understand that that surcharge, although the SR22 is strictly for liability insurance, the surcharge will go on the comprehensive and collision or the physical damage of the premium as well.
Okay. Any other questions? Great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wunghier. We will set aside HB 264, also an amendment deadline next Monday, March 9. Also going to take public testimony the subsequent Tuesday and look to the will of the committee at that time. HB 250 is the final bill on today's agenda, sponsored by Representative Hopkins, also a first hearing. Welcome, Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Representative Greyer Hopkins, Representative House District 4 in North Fairbanks. Thank you for hearing House Bill 250 today. My staff, who's been doing the vast majority of this research, is unavailable to be here today because he is flying down to interview for a national scholarship, the Truman Scholarship. He's one of 200 finalists in the country. So I said I'll cover it for you today. So thank you very much. So for the record, my name is Greyer Hopkins. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today on this wonderfully important bill invigorating youth voter registration and civic engagement. It's part of an ongoing effort that the legislature has taken over a number of years, you can find through different bills introduced, to take a detailed look at ways to improve our electoral process, but also bring into a new focus how to prepare young Alaskans to become more active and informed voters. This legislation was inspired largely by discussions I've had with young Alaskans, local educators, and fellow legislators from in the state and around the country. Fundamentally, House Bill 250 is about increasing access, knowledge, and participation in our democracy. House Bill 250 would allow young Alaskans who are at least 16 years old to pre-register to vote. It does not change the current legal age of voting. It simply extends the ability for young Alaskans to register to voluntarily pre-register to vote before they become eligible voters. Additionally, this bill does not affect the automatic voter registration through the permanent fund dividend application for a few key reasons. The automatic voter registration only applies to Alaskans who meet the eligibility requirements to be able to vote. 16 and 17-year-olds cannot legally vote and therefore would not be included in that automatic voter registration on their permanent fund dividend application. Through the expansion of our statutes to include citizens who are 16 years old, we create a longer period of time where young Alaskans are aware of the rights that they will gain upon turning 18 and can begin to develop the habits of informed and engaged voters. Moreover, allowing pre-registration gives our educators, families, and communities the tools to develop young Alaskans into informed and confident voters. When students turn 16, they have already begun taking government classes, history classes, and civics classes in school. Providing pre-registration opportunities in that classroom and outside of that classroom, offers real and tangible steps for students to take that give them real-world experience. Additionally, pre-registration is increasingly common across the nation. In fact, there are 23 states and the District of Columbia that are offering some sort of pre-registration before an individual turns 18. The results in these places have shown increases in younger voter participation and the indicators of being long-term voters developing good voting habits. For example, in Florida, analysis of state voter files indicates that in 2008, pre-registrants were 4.7% more likely to vote than those who were registered after they turned 18. And the number of pre-registrants went from 65,000 in 2004 to nearly 78,000 in 2008. Nearly 20% increase or so just over those 4 years as the program matured. Additionally, a study from Duke University, which is attached on basis under the documents file, found that pre-registration increases the probability that young voters will participate in elections by an average of just 2 percentage points to 13 percentage points and has similar impact on both young Democrats and young Republicans. So it is a nonpartisan impact. Furthermore, in addition to the study, voter pre-registration programs, success of pre-registration is maximized when election officials and educators work together as partners. This is why we have been working with local educators and organizations and stakeholders to determine the best method to approach this. I'd like to note, following my testimony and any questions you have for me, we do have the Ms. Amy Galloway, who's a teacher at West Valley High School, available to give testimony. She is the current Teacher of the Year and a civics teacher at West Valley High School. We also have letters from Ms. Galloway, from the Alaska Center for Education, the Alaska Center Education Fund, Kids Voting North Alaska, Native Movement, and Maida Buckley also. Maida Buckley was instrumental in Kids Voting North in Fairbanks and seeing it grow, and was also a high school teacher of mine. And she was also the 2019 Governor's Arts and Humanities Awards and a former educator, as I said. One of the main impetus for this bill, when I heard that this is an option that other states are looking at, is my interactions going back to my alma mater high school at West Valley in Fairbanks, where I often go back even, well, years before I had this job, and would go and talk to high school government classes and high school civics classes, and it was always the question the teacher would ask, how many people are registered to vote here? And you really only saw the few 18-year-olds in that class who had been able to turn 18 and had taken that step to vote. I want to give people who are younger than that the ability to say, yes, I'm ready to vote when I turn 18. I want them to proudly be able to raise their hand and start becoming more engaged in that process by paying more attention. It won't change their ability to vote early or not, but it will give them that additional engagement and the idea that when you promise to do something, even if it's years down the line, you are very much more likely to go do that thing you have pledged to do by signing your voter registration years earlier in this case. And so I hope to create more permanent voters in our state at a younger age as we hopefully move HB 250 forward this year. So thank you, and I'd like to make sure we get Ms. Amy Galloway the opportunity to testify, but of course I am available for any questions.
Let's start and see if there's any questions, then we can go to Ms. Galloway. Representative Story or Representative Vance, any questions? Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Hopkins. I have heard from other students who have talked about other states who have allowed students to start voting at the age of 16. So I'm wondering if you considered a bill to allow students to vote at the age of 16. What they were telling me, that not only were students voting more, and I like your bill, the idea of the bill, but they also said it made families vote more. It had more of an impact than just the student, because the student took more interest, started talking about issues, and therefore family members took notice, and it oftentimes spurred family members. So I think it's a good thing to be doing, and I'm wondering why you didn't take it a step farther, and they would be allowed to vote.
Representative Story, through the chair, I have heard of other places where, and I don't think they're in Alaska, but other places where 16-year-olds are able to vote in local elections, so municipal elections, school board, borough assembly, city council, and that has started to create those more consistent voters. In our bill here, we were just looking at what we have on the books here now and ways to expand that voter enfranchisement for state elections specifically, but of course presidential and municipal ones here. So we just wanted to keep the bill more simple and target specifically this approach to drive this dialogue within civics engagements for our students as they look forward. And again, just simplicity's sake for this legislation.
And I can perhaps add to that question. The Alaska Constitution states that the voting age is 18, so it would require a constitutional amendment. So.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's see. Representative Vance, did you have a question? Representative Vance.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have numerous questions. I'll just start with on the fiscal note analysis. It talks about the division will need to consult with the Department of Law to determine if the information of the minors is protected and not intended to be released with list available from the division. So there's a concern about the privacy of the minors because the division usually doesn't deal with underage, doesn't deal with minors. And so that would be a complete shift. And would require the department to institute new regulations. Is this something that you have considered in increasing more burden on the Division of Elections?
Representative Vance, to the chair, there is a fiscal note to the bill of $75,000, and some of that would be included in promulgating those regulations if they need be. These voters would not be active voters, so they would not be on the voter rolls. So the way I understand it, but again, there is a fiscal note to the bill for them to address some of these concerns, so we did look into that, yes. But because these individuals would not be active voters, while a lot of that information is public information, you can request, you know, the voter rolls for the state or for your district or whatever you want from Division of Elections. These individuals would not be active voters, so they would not be included on that. Currently, you can register to vote if you are 17 years or old, or 17 years old and will turn 18 within 30 days of a election. So there are some minors involved, but those might become active voters on the voter rolls. So we'd have to ask Division of Elections how they treat that exactly. But again, these won't be active voters, but we did provide financial assistance for them to go through that process within the fiscal note.
Follow up. So why do you feel that by lowering this age from what we currently have now at the age of 17, of getting that early registration, hey, you're going to be turning 18, this is, you know, coming of age, that you now get this privilege to being able to vote and being part of the process. Why do you feel it's so important to lower it to 16 and feel like it will increase participation that much more? I say that because maybe I'm an anomaly. I take my children with me voting, and they have sample, ballots that I give my children, and I say we read down the entire ballot. Just because there's a letter behind their name, we don't assume that we, you know, share the same values, so we need to research and have encouraged that, and I think that's something that we can do without adding a burden to the Division of Elections. So I'm just wondering why the need to bump it to 16 when we already have it in place for early registration.
Representative Vance, through the chair, I'm a strong advocate for finding ways to enfranchise more voters. Like I said, there is a $75,000 fiscal note on this bill with $7,500 per year going forward, so I don't think that's a hefty burden on the Division of Elections. But the Division of Elections is charged with also maintaining all of our voter enfranchisement opportunities. And so I think it's critical that we help start giving our younger and engaged citizens the opportunity to say, I'm a voter, I can't vote yet, but if they want to come meet with us, they can say, I am a registered voter, and I'm practicing that skill now by engaging with you and me as representatives as registered voters, because I think the more activity they do as registered voters makes them more engaged, makes them follow the rules more. And I don't know how much of an anomaly you were, because my parents took me voting all the time. And I got to press the little button and pull the lever and get the sticker and go through kids voting as well. Mm-hmm. But we do still see younger voters as in the lowest percentage of turnout through any age demographic. And while a lot of us, you know, were taken by our parents to vote, you do see a substantial drop-off when those students then turn 18 in college, and they forget to get around to it, because I was fairly forgetful in college. And the only time I forgot to vote was that first time as well, when I was away in college. And so starting that practice of having them engaged now, I believe, will help them become more consistent voters going in the future. There's no have to with this bill in terms of this is something that's going to, you know, turn around our municipal voter turnouts or things like that, which are, I'm assuming, fairly similar in all the different municipalities around the state of less than 20%. But again, giving them the opportunity to grow into this process and have another tool for civics teachers and government teachers to say, you are now part of the process. Let's have a different discussion as a pre-registered voter, or everybody in the class being able to pre-register right there, and a discussion of why you might or might not want to take on that responsibility as a voter, allows for a much more robust discussion in class and a much more positive experience.
I'm going to jump in on the question and the answer. If that's helpful.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think
prerogative of the chair.
Yeah, part of the answer also is that there's data and evidence that suggest that show that it increases the rate of voting. If your question was, how do we know this is going to increase the rate of voting, Representative Vance, a follow up.
Yes, follow up. Now, currently, when an Alaskan applies for a PFD, they can choose to, you know, they're automatically registered to vote, and I don't know what, how the early voting was 17, or the early registration was 17-year-olds, you know, how that fits into the PFD application. But I'm wondering how many other states have kind of an automatic registration like that, because part of the engagement of voting is just, first of all, being registered to vote. And that is now an automatic thing that we're seeing. Just starting to see the effects of that barely in the state. So I'm wondering how the automatic registration is going to impact these young voters.
Representative Vance, to the chair, these young voters would not be eligible for that automatic voter registration through the permanent fund dividend application because they're not 18 yet, and that kicks in once an individual turns 18. I just filed for my permanent fund dividend right before coming to this meeting, so I did have to put on my date of birth, so it is able to filter those out.
Follow up. Are there other states that have forms of automatic voter registration?
Representative Vance, to the chair, I'm not sure. Obviously, there's no other dividend application in other states, but we do have a rundown in your bill packet of all 23 other states that have some sort of pre-18-year-old voter registration, and it goes through what every state's options are. And I said 20, and like I said, 23 of them do have some form of it.
And I can chime in. I think there's 20 plus or minus 5 states in the country with some form of automatic voter reg. But as Representative Hopkins noted, none where the registration trigger or mechanism is like the PFD. We're unique in that regard. Because of time, I'm going to go to Ms. Galloway, who's online and invited testimony. Ms. Galloway, thank you for making yourself available today, and congratulations on your Teacher of the Year status. And please put yourself on record and present your testimony.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Amy Galloway, and I am from Fairbanks, and I'm representing myself, teachers, and I'm also the Alaska Teacher of the Year for 2020. I had some prepared testimony, but in listening to the questions, I think through the chair, I'd like to address Representative Vance's question about why do we need voter registration, early voter registration at 16. I think, unfortunately, you and Representative Hopkins are an anomaly. When I talk to my 14 through 18-year-old students, and I ask how many go with their parents to vote, I might get one in a class of 30. So I think that the need for early registration comes from when we prepare students to be citizens, we have to pair real life relevant opportunities with the learning we do in the school. So when we do kids voting, when I do a candidate forum, when I have representatives in to speak, if at the same time I can pair, here is how you register to vote, here is why you register to vote, here is why it's important to protect the integrity of elections, here is why it's important to understand how the process works. Like, it's a learning process. And so I think for me as an educator and the other educators I know, what this does is it picks up the ball that unfortunately many, many parents no longer do, which is really teach their students how the system works. And the great thing about schools doing it and teachers being empowered to do this is we're nonpartisan. We do this as here's what's an amazing part of being in a representative democracy. Your voice matters. I don't get to tell you what your voice is. You decide that, but here's how it works. So by having teachers being able to pre-register students at 16 years old, we can much more clearly explain to students, here's what a district is, here's why it's important to know your district, here's how to, like, it just makes the process more relevant, and then it allows students to ask questions and be supported to try and empower them when they do go vote to then continually keep voting. Because 18 to 24 year olds were about 6% of our electorate in the last election. So I think that's all I wanted to say about that specifically. And then I will take any questions you might have about what this might look like in schools.
Thank you, Ms. Galloway. Any questions for Ms. Galloway from the committee? Representative Story?
Thank you for calling in, Ms. Galloway, and congratulations on your honor as Teacher of the Year for 2020. You had just said you, could you give me an idea of how you feel that would work in schools?
Sure. Through the chair, the way I see it, like what I can say what works in the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District is many times during election or when teaching, say, the Constitution, we do civic projects, whether it's kids voting or whether it's doing our school does a candidate forum. I know that there is the Youth Ambassador Program where 16 and 17-year-olds can actually volunteer at the polls. That's a state of Alaska program. When students engage in those type of activities, then we can also say, and if you would like to register to vote, here's how to register to vote, and we can have registrars there and registration drives and the League of Women Voters. And so in connection with what we teach in school, students can then have this relevant experience to say, oh, I am now registered, and when I turn 18, I am ready to go.
Thank you.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah, it gave me a picture of it, and through the chair, I hear what you're saying about lower. I know in Juneau we have, in a good election, we'll have 35% of registered voters come out to vote, and I see this, and I hear you saying, and please confirm that you also feel that this would help perhaps more. Families vote if their students were also voting. I don't want to put those thoughts into your mind, but what do you feel about that statement?
Sure. Through the chair, I already experienced that. I mean, as a civics educator, I am constantly teaching about the elections, and I have homework assignments about talking to their parents about elections, and so if students are registering to vote, it's just going to it opens up that conversation even more to the responsibility of citizens in our republic to be able to go out and take part in that. So I 100% agree that it opens dialogue and students could positively peer pressure their parents as well.
Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to... Ms. Galloway, are you limited in the ability to teach anything about, the impact of voting and civics without this bill?
Yes, I would say the limit comes in when I do our candidate forum and when I do kids voting. Students feel a lack of authenticity because they can't actually do anything. And so I think the programs are great, there is a bit that falls short because it's just something they're doing in school and they don't even really have a voice. So now while they won't actually be able to vote, to be able to take part in the legitimate legal registration process, I think would give that authenticity to students and break down kind of that last barrier of why does this matter to me because I can't even vote. They don't care what we think. And so I think that it would break down that limit that I have right now, is that everything just seems made up because they don't have a say or there's nothing they can do.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Galloway, for making the time today. It's 4:55. Perhaps entertain one last question from the committee if there is one. Otherwise, set this bill aside for hearing it again next week. Is there another question? I'm looking at you, Representative Vance, because you said you had several.
Well, I have concerns about parental rights issues and handing more of that responsibility to the schools. And if the schools are taking on the responsibility of, hey, we're gonna pre-register your kids to vote, then I think that gets parents inclined to do less. And I think that's we want to be encouraging parents to engage with their kids more, and that it's their responsibility to engage their kids. Yes, it is. We have great educators that we want to teach civics classes, we want to teach history, we want to teach government, but we can't neglect the partnership that parents must have and the sole responsibility to teach their children. And it just feels like a slide that I don't want to send a message to parents of, hey, we've got this, we're going to take over this area of responsibility with your young adults, and see that happening on so many other levels over the past generations, you know, like with home ec and things like that. I would like to see more of the parents saying, hey, you know what, we've not been doing this, how can we partner with education in my responsibility for this? So I know that isn't something directly in the responsibility of this bill, but it's just some of the concerns over the general topic that I have.
Got it. Thank you for the comment, Representative Vance, and Representative Hopkins, as sponsor, let you make any closing comment before we adjourn the meeting sometime in the next 120 seconds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your questions. I guess I don't have too many statements besides this does allow the dialogue to be driven in the classrooms, as well as the students taking home the story of, hey, other kids pre-registered to vote today. I've debated about it. What do you think about it, parents? And having that dialogue start at home, coming from the students, being able to engage the parents in that same dialogue. So I think this does help drive that home discussion through this process of pre-registration. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Blissfully succinct. Thank you so much. Well, we blasted through three bills today. Thank you all for your forbearance. Next meeting is Tuesday, March 10. Thank you, Martha and Madison. We're back to 5 of 7 here, ending on a high note. And at 4:58, we are adjourned.